Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are both scientists working in the field of genetics. It is 50 years this autumn since Professor David McConnell first went to Trinity College as an undergraduate student with an interest in physics. But he soon discovered genetics, and over the course of his distinguished career has been among a group of scientists who have made Ireland a world leader in the field of genetic research. Dr. Aoife McLeisett is Associate Professor of Evolutionary Genetics and, like generations of Trinity Science students, was taught by David. Not only did he teach her himself, but he introduced her to other scientists who have been key mentors in her career. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel I'm in the presence of two incredibly clever people, so I better up my game.
Well, we want to dispute that.
But were you always interested in science and genetics? How did you get into this field, Aoife?
I suppose I really like solving puzzles, and I suppose I saw science as solving puzzles for a living, maybe. But I really liked it in school. I had a really good science teacher who actually was a contemporary of yours, David, Nick Fruin, who was my science teacher. But he was great, and I really enjoyed it. And then when I went to college, I still wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do, though. I liked science, and I also had on my CAO form, I had history and politics. So I had a variety of interests. But science was definitely my first choice. And it just, I suppose it's what caught my interest.
And did you always have an interest in genetics from the word go?
I had an interest in genetics quite early. What we saw in school was very limited, and I didn't realise actually how big genetics is and how you can study so many different things. I mean, it's an approach to looking at biology in general, and you can use genetics to study bacteria, you can use genetics to study infectious viruses, and you can talk about human evolution, and you can do so much with genetics. And I didn't realise all of that, and so it was actually much better than I thought it was. But when I was an undergraduate, I remember attending David's lecture and enjoying them. And I think the thing that really caught me about genetics was that it felt like it was based on understanding big principles and then seeing this throughout nature, rather than, I was never one of these people who liked memorizing lots of little details. It felt like memorizing the phone book or something like that. So genetics, it really felt like it was really the principles that were important. And then you learn facts because they are evidence for those principles. But it wasn't just memorizing. I found memorizing so dull. And so I found genetics really fun and exciting.
Where did you first get your interest in genetics or science even?
Well, science was at school. A wonderful science teacher, a man called John McCarthy, was a graduate of UCC, a great, bluff, big Cork man. And he taught me maths and physics for 7 years in succession. And then another teacher, who was actually a student teacher, a man called Peter Brown, who wasn't supposed to be teaching science at all, but one day he came into what is a class, believe it or not, on religion. And he said to us, "What would you like me to talk about this morning?" And Brian Denham, one of my classmates, said, "The atom, sir." So we had an hour on the atom instead of religion. And the next class, same question, Brian Denham said, "Evolution, sir." And it was just wonderful. My eyes were opened. I was only 14, I think, at the time. And suddenly to be introduced to the idea of evolution in a casual way, not because we had to learn it, but just because this man, who was a chemistry student, could stand up and just talk about it in the most beautiful way.
Isn't it amazing that you both remark, though, on how teachers...
Teachers are crucial.
Yeah.
Absolutely essential. And, you know, I say to some of my students they sometimes come slightly apologetically, you know, we've been trying to persuade them to be geneticists, and sometimes they come to me and say, "David, you're going to be very disappointed in me. I've decided to do teaching." And I said, "Well, teachers are the most important people of all." And that's, I feel it very, very strongly. And I'm so proud when our students go off to become teachers.
Yeah, they're amazingly influential.
Yeah.
So what kind of a teacher was David?
Oh.
Nice segue.
That's getting personal.
Yes. Well, I'd say challenging in the right way. One of the things that's fun about science is that it doesn't give up its secrets easily. And if you are spoon-fed, then you don't have the fun of science anymore. The fun of science is discovering something. And if you can do it in a lecture where you're going through a lecture and you feel like you've kind of discovered it along the way, rather than just been told, "What's 2 plus 2? It's 4. You know, if you feel that you've discovered it while you were listening, then you kind of get a bit of a buzz. And I think David was very good at doing that. I actually remember one specific example when we were in, it was in first year, and you were talking about something. I won't go into the details here, but it was to do with the repetitive DNA. And it was the, so he gave this puzzling result.
What were the details?
Well, it was what it is. If you pull DNA apart, you call it melting it. It's chopped up and melted, and try and let it stick itself back together again. It has to find its matching part. And there was some DNA that found its matching part really quickly, so it would stick back together really quickly. And David just asked the lecture theatre, you know, who has any idea why it would be like this? And I remember one of my good friends, Karen O'Donoghue, who was sitting beside me, put up her hand and said, there must be loads of repeats. So basically, it's easy to find a match if there are lots of copies of you versus only one unique one that you've got to
find. That's a fantastic answer for a junior freshman first year student. Yes. That is just brilliance.
I was so jealous that she came up with the answer. I was so envious of her. So she was the brilliant one who was smart and got that really quickly. And so I remember that. I remember really wanting to be the person who could come up with the answers. I think that was part of it.
And of course, because you have a lot of students, you wouldn't have encountered Aoife at the very early stages. And wasn't there a story that you met each other in Crumlin Hospital?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you even remember this, David. He mightn't remember this. But in the summer in between first and second year college, I volunteered in Crumlin Hospital. It was just new at the time. It's the National Centre for Medical Genetics, I think is the proper name of it. And I went along and I volunteered there. And I remember actually when I first went in, I just emailed them. It was actually Brian Denham who helped me get in touch with them. So it's very funny that you were a classmate of his. Yes. Because I knew him a little bit as a doctor and I liked him. It was he introduced me, and I went and I went there and I said I'd like to work for the summer, and so I volunteered to work there. And they were asking me about Trinity, and they said, oh, do you know Dave McConnell? And I did, in the sense that I was in one of the 200 or 300 people in the room, so I knew him, but he didn't know me. And so I might have slightly bigged it up. But and then during the summer when I was there working, I was at a bench working away, and David came in to have a tour because it was a relatively new facility. And just as they were coming into the room where I was, I heard one of them saying, and we've got one of your students here. And he came around and saw me and said, I don't know who that is. And I was mortified.
Honesty.
Like I got there under false pretenses or something. But
I know you had a sister, didn't you, who had an illness?
Yes, so I have two sisters. One of them, Niamh, was ill, but it wasn't actually a genetic condition. She had several problems. She had heart problems, which is part of how I know Brian Denham. He was her doctor. She went to Crumlin Hospital, so that was part of my emotional connection to Crumlin Hospital. I ran the mini marathon for them a few times, and that summer I went and worked in the genetics department. It was part a way of giving something back to that hospital, I suppose, and that was where my talent appeared to be more towards genetics than something else. Tried to do it that way.
But she didn't make it, did she?
No, she died when she was 16, when I was in first year in college. So it was just that summer that I went to. It was the summer after that I went to Crumlin Hospital to work.
When that happens, when you're in first year, how did you deal with that?
It was very difficult, especially for my parents. I think it's still difficult for them. And but I suppose part of it is, you know, it's a very abrupt lesson that life is short. And I think it has affected my personality in the sense that I kind of don't tolerate nonsense. I'm like, life's too short for that. Like if I ever think there's a misunderstanding with somebody, either a colleague or a friend, I address it straight away. Even, you know, I go, I think we probably have a misunderstanding here. Mm. I feel that quite strongly, actually, that's one of the things that came out of it for me is, yeah, life's short and just no time for nonsense. But so it was, I suppose it's one of those things though, you deal with it. I don't know how to describe how I dealt with it, but I put my head down as well. Kept working.
Fun. But at the end of second year, didn't you select Aoife to work in bioinformatics, did you? Whatever that is you're going to tell me about.
What I remember was that I used to run a problem course, and Aoife did exceptionally well in it. And she said earlier that she loves doing puzzles. And it's a really important quality for geneticists, indeed scientists in general, how solve puzzles. If I sometimes ask people, do you do Sudoku? Do you do Crossair? Do you play bridge? You know, yeah. Do you play chess? Any of these things? Do you play poker? All of these things are puzzle solving. And yeah. Do you back the horses? You know, it doesn't matter. These are all exercise in puzzle solving. And Aoife was absolutely outstanding at it. And I did ask her to do to revamp the course, was it? Or I forget exactly.
Well, I remember
okay, maybe
very
see it
specific.
Later.
I remember very clearly, yeah. So, because I was at home working in my dad's nursery, sowing sweet pea, which I think is funny, seeing as Mendel used it.
Yes.
I was working, it was my part-time job, was working for my dad. And I got this, I get my, somebody, probably one of, somebody in my family going, there's somebody called Professor McConnell on the phone for you. And so I had to go and answer the phone. And then you asked me if I'd go in and work during the summer. And I ended up working for Andrew Lloyd.
Yes.
And it was working in this area that was completely new to me called bioinformatics, which is basically using computers to analyze biological data. And I hadn't even heard the word before, bioinformatics. And so I ended up working in this for the summer. And the task that Andrew Lloyd set for me was to write a course in bioinformatics. So I don't know what bioinformatics is, and I had to write a course in it. So I was starting from zero. And at the end of 6 weeks, I had to have a course in this, and it actually worked. And I think kind of the fact that I was new to it helped, because I could very easily relate to people who were new to it and the things they needed to start with.
We called it ABC. Aoife's bioinformatics course. And it was there for years and years and years as ABC, Aoife's bioinformatics course.
What is bioinformatics?
So it's just
in a sentence.
Computer analysis of biological data. So in my case, DNA sequences. DNA sequences and protein sequences, analysing them. And
that's essentially where Aoife's career has come from.
Is it very rewarding for someone like you, David, to spot, I suppose, the new generation of people like yourself?
In other words, I don't think of it in those terms, but just to see amongst my students just terrific interest. And, some students are, of course, cleverer than others. And I don't care. What I'm interested in is whether they're interested. And I can remember occasions when I've seen students' eyes literally light up in front of me when I've been talking about something. And I remember a particular case of 2 or 3 years ago when a very, very bright student reacted in a way which I thought, yes, that was a bullseye from my point of view. That I give this course of tutorials on science, philosophy and ethics to try to encourage students to think about what is science, what is philosophy, and therefore to try to encourage them to have to develop their own ethics and to think about their ethics. Because most of us, as you probably know, we get our ethics essentially from our parents, who comes by osmosis. We don't think about it as much as we should. I want to get them thinking. In any case, this course of tutorials. And I was talking about something I know very little about, but I say to them, I don't know very much about it. And I was telling them about some of the ideas of George Berkeley, the great, great Irish philosopher. And I won't bother you with the details, but in any case, it's very strange stuff, really weird stuff.
Like what? Give me one idea.
Well, he has this puzzle. Imagine we're in a room, as we are today, and there is a table, and there is a table in front of us. And we all leave the room, and there's nobody looking. Does the table exist? And he said, the only existence that the table has is through it being perceived, esse est percipi in Latin. So you have to imagine the world outside us. We're looking at this world. Does it exist independently of us? If we are not there, does the world exist? Now, Berkeley used this indirectly as a proof of God, that God is there, so the world exists, because God's always looking at it. But leaving all that aside, this guy suddenly realized that the world that he's seeing through his eyes may not really exist. It may be because he is seeing it. And I could see him starting to wonder. His whole physique sort of changed. He didn't say anything, but I saw him react. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. And then the other, last year indeed, same course, the students have to write an essay at the end of it. And one of my students wrote an essay on Kant, the great German philosopher. And it was really terrific. And it wouldn't surprise me if this student ended up as a philosopher. And that sort of thing, now that's something completely separate from science. That's just seeing a student beginning to think.
But if you do what you both do on a daily basis, looking at the wonder of science and genetics, maybe that's very akin and connected to philosophy. In other words, yeah, of course.
Well, I mean, Russell said it years ago, and many others have said it. Philosophy has been, to some extent, contracted by science. Science has moved into the into the field of philosophy and has informed philosophy. So, but you're still faced with the great philosophical questions, which, as Russell said again, the problem with science is it probably can't answer these great questions. So there are these wonderful questions. But scientists wonder about, that's what we do. We wonder, and we are faced with this wonder of the world around us. That's what,
But that's wonderful.
Yeah. It is.
I
it
love
is.
That. How did you get into this field? I mean, are your family scientists, Aoife?
No. So my dad is a horticulturalist, and my mum...
That's a bit of science.
Yeah, there's science. Yeah, they're practical in that sense. And but my grandfather... I suppose that's the strongest link. My grandfather was a genealogist.
Is that Edward MacLeod?
Yes. And so he's a genealogist studying Irish surnames, especially. Thinking of the family tree is a form of genetics, actually. Mm. So there's new tools for it today. Mm. And actually, I had a very nice experience because when I was a student in not my project, but in another lab in the department. So my colleague, Dan Bradley, was looking at Irish ancestry. And so they were trying to study Irish ancestry and they wanted a way to try and figure out where people were generations ago. So today everybody's moved so much. People aren't from Dublin anymore or from Mayo. Everyone moves all over the place. But we have a strong surname tradition and you get your surname from your father all back through the generations. And you also get your Y chromosome from your father. So they could look at the genetics of the Y chromosome, use the surname and my grandfather's work, which says that MacLeod is a Clare surname, for example. And you know, a MacLeod man has a Clare Y chromosome. And so they looked at the genetics and they mapped the genetic diversity onto the map of Ireland and they could see the pattern. And this was using my granddad's book as a reference, so I was very pleased with that. It would have been just better if it was me, if it was my project. It would have been a perfect circle closing. But
it's a lovely link, nevertheless, isn't it?
And then it goes on in the most extraordinary ways because one of the people who worked on that project was Emmy Hill. And Emmy is now a professor at UCD and she's looking at the genealogy of thoroughbred horses and has discovered a gene in thoroughbred horses, which appears to predict the performance of thoroughbred horses. So, Aoife said it earlier, I mean, the genetics goes into almost everything. It does. It goes into every part of biology. And the same logic that Emmy was using with Dan Bradley all those years ago on Irish surnames can be applied essentially to the surnames of horses.
That's fascinating.
Think about it.
It is brilliant. Yeah. And your family were pharmacists and weavers, is that right, Ed?
My grandfather was indeed a pharmacist, and going back to my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather, and he is recorded as having opened a pharmacy in what is today O'Connell Street. And if you go back a little further than that, then my family are weavers. That line of my family were weavers from the Coombe. But that didn't influence me, strangely. Because my grandfather died when I was young and there were girls only in the family. And unfortunately, neither my mother nor her sisters became pharmacists. So that was lost, tragically, I think.
But look, we're going to take the first piece of music, Aoife, which is a piece you love.
The Kate Bush song. Yeah. I love Kate Bush. She's got an amazing voice. And part of the reason for choosing this song was the title, This Woman's Work. And I suppose being a scientist... there aren't so many of us who are women as well. And so it's nice to think about that and to think about the added value of having women, I think.
I agree.
These are endless discussions I have in different fields about not enough women. Why do you think there aren't enough women in science?
Lots of complicated reasons. I think part of it is that some people think that women don't think that way, and they think even that girls don't think that way. So it can start young. And I have heard kind of shocking examples, considering they're not from 100 years ago, where there's a friend of mine was told by her child's teacher, and when she needed a little bit of help with maths, and the teacher said, "Oh, you know, but girls aren't good at maths." And I couldn't believe that anybody would say that today. But it gets more complicated than that, I think. And girls aren't choosing maths and physics as much. Though I was at the higher options fair, and there were loads of girls. They were coming up to me, going, "I'm good at maths. How do I get to do maths?" And I was just so pleased with how confident they were as well, you know. And they were like, "I really like maths, and I'm good at it. So how do I get into that in university?" And it was brilliant.
But you'd be a great role model.
You do need some positive encouragement, and so either a role model who's the, maybe also a woman, or people who just tell you, come on, you can do it. That helps.
So that's why you love Kate Bush.
The title seemed apt, I think. Okay.
Kate Bush there with this woman's work. You both work in the area of genetics. What is the study of genetics?
Study of heredity. Why you resemble your parents or your grandparents. Why brothers and sisters resemble each other. Why identical twins are identical to each other to all intents and purposes. Hard to distinguish. Their genes are identical. Why is that? Why some people have blue eyes, some people have brown eyes. All those simple things. Why, sadly, why some people are affected by genetic disorders. Cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy and so on. So your genes are these things which actually cause you to be the way you are. It's information, biological information, which is specifying you or a carnation or a worm or whatever.
But in your 50 years, say, of studying it, has it raised more questions for you?
I mean, it is astonishing. I mean, in the middle 60s, genetics meant almost nothing to the general public. It had almost no effect on society of any kind, except for one thing, which I always like to recall, and that is that geneticists masterminded something called the Green Revolution, which was a fantastic increase in the productivity of wheat and rice during the 1950s, which relieved the famines of Southern Asia and the Central America and that area. Astonishing achievement. But genetics had almost no influence on medicine in those days. No influence on industry, no biotechnology, which is something that grew out of genetics, no GM. Nowadays, people are talking about it all the time. It's in your genes. It's in your DNA. Now it's part of common knowledge.
I suppose we all say it.
Yeah.
We do.
And everybody knows that, you know, we're 99% chimp at the DNA level. And that's actually the lovely story of that. So the woman who discovered that was Mary Claire King. It was part of her PhD work with a guy called Alan Wilson. And we gave her an award a couple of years ago. We have a Dawson Prize named after the founder of our department. And she told us the story when she was here because years before she had come to Ireland on a holiday with her daughter as a treat for her daughter. And they were driving around. And in one remote part of the country, they're driving past a big billboard that was just completely green with white writing on it, and at the top it just said, scientists say human and chimp are 99% the same, and at the bottom, drink Guinness. And her daughter just turned to her and went, Mom, that's you. And so it was, you know, in her own lifetime, this goes from a revolutionary, surprising discovery to being the punchline.
We punch above our weight in genetics. I mean, I'll talk about science in a moment, but why is that? Why do you think in Ireland we do have a very good reputation in the area?
It's solely a question of people. In the first instance, a group of people over the years went into genetics relatively early. George Dawson, who founded our department in 1958, led genetics in Ireland, laid the basis for it. He was outstanding as a teacher and as a leader. And he attracted some very good people to work with him. And then, and in other universities, people became interested in genetics. I think of Frank Gannon in Galway and Fergal O'Gara in Cork. And these people went abroad, came back and developed genetics in other universities. And then it just grew. So people coming in, going away to some of the best labs in the world, and then, as Aoife did, went off to UC Riverside.
Irvine,
in California. And then fortunately,
coming back,
we were able to attract them back, which is the crucial thing. And the other thing, I suppose, which was important was that genetics became more and more relevant, and it became important at different stages to different things that the people in general were interested in. So biotechnology emerged in the 70s and the 80s, and we participated in trying to encourage the development of biotechnology in Ireland. Medical genetics developed a little later, and we contributed to that. And it's all about ideas at the right time and wonderful people.
And yet, don't you feel quite strongly that since 1922 the state here hasn't supported science enough.
1922 was a watershed in Ireland for many, many different reasons. And one of the consequences of 1922 was that Irish science gradually withered away. It had been as good as science more or less anywhere in the world up until then. But I'm afraid the governments of Ireland between 1922 and on into the late 50s, even into the early 60s, one would say, didn't see science as important. Except in, there were some exceptions to that, but by and large, science was not on the agenda.
Why do you think they thought that?
The ideals of the objectives of the new Irish state simply didn't include science at all. They were focused on Irishness, broadly speaking, especially the Irish language, but much wider than that. I mean, the notion was to recreate an Irish Ireland in every respect. And of course, there was a tremendous influence of the church to re-establish a position of the church in Ireland, well, even to strengthen it, I suppose, a better way of putting it. And then the notion of separation from Britain and making clear distinctions between Britain, summarised in two words, which have been very damaging, Sinn Féin. We ourselves, ourselves alone. We wanted to cut ourselves off fundamentally and to develop in Ireland on our own. Science is cosmopolitan, international, forward-looking, open, independently minded, full of imagination, full of questions. The Ireland that was we were trying to create during this period was almost the opposite of all of those words.
Didn't De Valera, though, set up the Institute of Advanced Studies, to be fair to him?
He did, which was a terrific thing that he did, but I think it was an aberration on his part. I want to find out more about this, but I think the evidence suggests that there was almost no interest, for example, in education per se. Education, yes, to teach people how to speak Irish, but education to encourage them to be independently minded, imaginative, thoughtful, creative. No, that was far too dangerous.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
What area do you work in now? Do you specialise in?
It's evolutionary genetics. We're trying to use evolution to figure out which genes are kind of fragile in the sense that disrupting them could lead to disease. And so we're trying to see that in terms of evolution, because evolution has a very strict and heartless response to the things that don't work and in terms of eliminating them. So you can see the patterns over evolution of what works and what doesn't work, and try and use that information to understand which genes are susceptible to disease, which might lead to disease. So that's the general idea.
So in a sense, almost all of what you are doing can be used to better, I suppose, mankind, if you think about it.
I think it might. You can't guarantee that ahead of time. And I suppose that's part of the difficulty, perhaps, for politicians who are working on an election cycle. That it doesn't happen that quickly is the first thing. And you don't know ahead of time. The whole point of doing an experiment is that it's the first time you're doing it and you don't know what the result is. You have hopes and you have aims, but you don't know if it's necessarily going to work out that way. And it's hard sometimes, I think, for people to accept that you might do something and you don't actually know if it's going to work. Anybody can point at a project that failed because you have projects you start out and they don't work. But overall, science works and it's had amazing discoveries. And I like to give the example actually of the laser as a nice example of where you can't predict what will come, because the laser was discovered / invented as a physics project about the strange properties of peculiar light. So it's just a specific kind of light. Nobody wrote a project proposal to a government funding agency saying, I want to invent a laser so that we can have laser eye surgery, so that we can have CD players, so that we can have really fast data transfer. These things didn't exist until the laser made them possible. So nobody anticipated this. And you can't anticipate everything. And if you limit yourself to only doing things that you anticipate, that you can precisely see, then you'll tweak what you have. You'll never create something completely new.
Can I give you an example from Aoife's own field? Way back in the 1950s, two or three labs in the world were puzzled by something called restriction and modification in bacteria. It doesn't matter what it is. And it looked as though restriction and modification was a phenomenon which was counter to what Darwin's idea concerning evolution was. So these bacterial geneticists were working on restriction and modification. They would never be funded today because there was no conceivable result from this. But out of that came the discovery of things called restriction enzymes, which has has led to genetic engineering, which has led to biotechnology, which has totally changed so many different aspects of modern life, including, for example, the production of human insulin in yeast, treatment of diabetics. GM crops comes out of this. Forensic DNA, revolution in forensic science, all comes out of those two or three labs, in Europe mostly, trying to figure out what was the phenomenon called restriction. And that led to restriction enzymes, which led directly to genetic engineering, which changed everything.
That's so interesting. But just one more question to you on this. Gene therapy, I mean, is the hope that one day gene therapy will cure most diseases?
I think the word most is the problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we know quite a bit about this because our wonderful colleagues, Pete Humphreys and Jane Farrar and Paul Kenner, who work on the genetics of blindness, they are working very hard, have been now for more than 10 years, on trying to develop gene therapy for blindness. And they've made some progress at the laboratory level. But there is progress being made at the clinical level. But the cases that can be treated with gene therapy at the moment are incredibly, incredibly small in number. Mm. And there are thousands of different genetic disorders, thousands and thousands. Having gene therapy to work for all of those is, I think, going to be just an unimaginably difficult task. And then there's another big problem, of course, is most diseases are what we call polygenic, multifactorial diseases, say like heart disease. The idea that you can just pick a single gene and change it, that's possible in some specific cases, we think, okay? But that you can change many genes, that's a problem.
I think it is easy sometimes to oversimplify things. There are lots of conditions that have a genetic component, and that is just a part of it. But I think there's also sometimes maybe there is a risk of people being overconfident with genetics, thinking so there's this the bad history, the dirty history of genetics is eugenics, when people thought they knew more than they knew and thought they could correct things and thought they could make, you know, more intelligent people and things like this. And that is a lack of humility, a severe lack of humility.
Lack of understanding of genetics?
Yes. They didn't realize they didn't understand. That's why...
Mostly they weren't geneticists. They were psychologists and others, I can tell you, back in the 30s in Germany, who led this particularly awful phase.
And we're going to take a piece of music. So do we have music in our DNA, to use a cliche?
I'm sure we do. This is the nature versus nurture thing, which is where I spend a lot of my time as a geneticist trying to explain the environment is really, really important, you know. And if you take music, there's a very good example. You know, if there's no music in the family, if there are no musical instruments around, how can you really become a musician? But then you have to imagine that somebody... That in somebody like some of these extraordinary musicians, you have to imagine that there's some genes involved as well. And that comes from a general point. There is almost nothing, I would say there is nothing, no quality of a person which does not have some genetic background somewhere. And for music, of course, there's got to be genes. Quote, hate this term, genes for music.
But like in terms of music, your mother, I think, and your grandmother both played the piano, but... You don't, or do you?
No, I don't. No, my mother was a very fine pianist and she won competitions in the Fechgyol and so on. And my grandmother was a trained music teacher. She left Dublin in the early 1900s and was sent to London to study at the Royal Academy of Music. She wanted me to study the piano, but I said I was too busy, please. I'm doing too many other things. Okay, do I have to play the piano? Yeah.
So this is a Beethoven piece you've asked for.
I think that one of the most wonderful pieces of music is Beethoven's Piano Concerto in E-flat major, The Emperor. So it's one of the most magical things that human beings have ever created.
Beautiful Emperor Concerto. You love it, don't you, David?
I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Fascinating, the relationship between science and God. Are both of you religious or not?
Not. Well, we're both atheist, actually. And yes. For me, there's no place or no need for God. I mean, I don't need it to feel better about life. I don't need it to feel like a better person. I don't need it for moral guidance. And I certainly don't need it as an explanation for where we came from and what the universe is. One of the areas where science and religion come into conflict is the creation story. So religions have this creation story, and science tells us that it's not that story, that it's evolution, and it's a very beautiful story in its own way. But I also see that people who were coming up with this story were trying to answer the same questions we're trying to answer. They're trying to say, where did we come from? How did it all begin? And they came up with a story that worked for them and seemed to be the best they could do at the time. And then the problem comes from when at some point some people decided, okay, you know, that's now just to be untouched and left as is, and nobody is allowed to revise that from now on. Nobody's allowed to contribute a new thought to this ever. So that's where the conflict comes from.
Did you always think like that? Or is the study of science and what you are not now doing in your life something that made you an atheist?
I don't think studying science made me an atheist, but I think the same thought processes that allow me to be a scientist also led me to think about other things as well, including religion. Plenty of scientists are religious, and so there isn't a direct conflict there. But I think that the same tendency in me to challenge ideas, to think about things, not to just accept everything. This is part of what you do as a scientist. Somebody says, look, I've done this and I think it's this way. And you look at it and you go, actually, you know, I disagree. And that's how science moves. It's a series of disagreements. So the same process of looking at something and thinking about it critically, I think, is what led me to become atheist. I don't feel bad about it. I don't feel an absence of anything. I suppose back to the idea that life is short. This is your life. So I don't have any belief in any kind of afterlife at all. And so now's the time to do it. Be nice to people now, not because somebody's watching over you and will punish you for it, but because it's good to be nice to people. And so some people think that atheists don't have morals. It's absolutely not true. But it's just, who makes me be a good person? Well, it's my own intention to be a good person, and it's not the threat of punishment or hell and damnation that does it for me.
And you, David?
I couldn't say it any better. Absolutely wonderful. Science did affect me, though. I mean, those few classes on the atom and on evolution from Peter Brown all those years ago, that caused me to think in a way I had never thought before. And yes, and I found I mean, when you began to analyse what you were being taught, as it were, in church or in Sunday school or whatever, and you asked, well, what does this mean? And then you know, dissect it a little bit.
And yet I remember interviewing a physicist years ago in London, and he is a believer. And in fact, he had the opposite journey. Like, isn't it true, for instance, if you ask what is the universe, that a physicist at this stage only knows 4% of what the universe is made up of?
Absolutely extraordinary. They can identify and know about 4% of what, broadly speaking, is called the stuff of the universe.
Yeah, but the other 96% then needs to be explained, which is why this physicist was saying to me he was quite religious.
But that's God of the gaps. And it's an old, old problem, you know, that if you don't have an answer, call in God. Dial up God for all the answers.
But we're more than a sum of our physical parts, aren't we? People talk about the soul, that people have a soul.
Yes, well,
and you both look at me skeptically and just say, she's mad.
The idea of the soul as being something separate from our biological system, I find really, yes, it just doesn't make any sense to me. We are the sum of our biological bits and pieces, and we still don't know what the brain is, how it works. We know electricity is really important in the brain. We know chemistry is really important in the brain. But trying to understand exactly how we're having this conversation now in biological terms,
what goes on in your brain? And so the soul is, you know, if you want to think of it that way, it's something in your personality, something in you, but it's in your brain and it's physical. Your memories, your ideas, all of those things are in your brain, physically laid out in your brain, not just some kind of ghostly metaphorical things, but they're laid out in your brain physically with the proteins and the chemicals in your brain, and that's how they're stored. We don't understand it exactly, but we know it's physical because you just need to think about somebody getting a brain injury and they lose some memories. It's very hard to think of a thought as being a physical collection of proteins on the surface of neurons in the brain. That's what it is.
But if there was no greater force, why is there? And I think
there's no answer to the question.
Why is there something rather than nothing?
There is something. There is no answer to that question at the moment.
And we didn't need to exist. I mean, it's not that
evolution, this is Stephen Jay Gould's great idea, that if you ran the clock of evolution again from, say, 3 billion years ago, there's no reason to believe that human beings would have evolved on the planet. And by the way, evolution must have occurred on many other planets in the universe. Undoubtedly, there are living systems on other planets in the cosmos.
Or there have been. There could be extinct already.
Or there
already.
Have been. But there are so many planets in the cosmos, there must be other living systems. And they'll all be different in every planet. I mean, you have to let your mind run very, very freely. But that is a perfectly ordinary scientific statement.
You seem neither bleak nor lonely. But is there a bleakness and loneliness when maybe after 50 years of studying science, there doesn't seem to be any explanation?
The greatest loneliness that I have is when somebody dies. When a friend of mine dies, then I know that's the end. I will never see those people again. I will have their memories, but for a person who has a profound religious belief of what you might call standard kind, they expect to meet again. But for somebody like myself and Aoife, I think, it's the end. And that is, for me, I find death really, really hard. I find it terribly hard because it's the end.
So neither of you would reach for the comfort of God. It must be quite comforting then for people who do have a faith.
I expect it is, yeah.
Or fearful, depends.
Well, yeah, there's the fear of punishment. But it'd be nice if it was true. I mean, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be nice?
You have Pascal's bet. He said something to the effect, well, I'll believe in God because if that's true, that's okay. And if it's not true, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but there's some comfort in that. With your own children, well, yours are very young, Aoife, yeah. 6 and 8. Yeah. But they have scientific minds.
Yes. One day when I'd picked my kids up from school and I brought them for an ice cream on the way home, and we're there just getting the ice cream. And my son started asking me a question and I didn't hear him. And I had to get him to repeat it 3 times. And he just said to me, "Is space everything or nothing?" And the girl who was getting the ice cream just went, "Good luck."
And what did you say?
Well, we were discussing it a bit and I went, "Well, you know, it is everything, but it's mostly made of nothing," I think is what we ended up at. And my daughter comes out with amazing questions as well. Like one day she said to me, "Is your brain the thinking part of you, or are you the thinking part of your brain?" Which is another question that had me flummoxed for a while. Yeah, and she started reasoning it out. I was really impressed by her, actually, because I started trying to talk to her in ways I thought she'd understand. And then she went, "No, I think you're the thinking part of your brain because, you know, you can change other parts of your body and you're still you, but you can't change your brain." And I was like, "Yeah, pretty good, yeah."
Future scientists already.
Oh, yes.
And your children and grandchildren, David, did they follow you into any fields?
No. My elder son is a lawyer, a solicitor. And my younger son is in an IT company.
But look, we're going to end on a piece of music, which is almost about what you both do, because I sit before you and I can see you absolutely love what you do. It's kind of this wonderful world, isn't it?
Yeah. I think I'm very lucky to have the chance to do something that I enjoy so much. I get, like I was saying at the beginning, I love to solve puzzles, and now I get to do that every day. And I really love being involved with students, getting to interact with them, and hopefully inspire a few. Who knows if I get the chance to, you know, inspire some students the same way that David has.
Did you learn a lot from David McConnell?
Definitely, yes.
But let me tell you, the boot's on the other foot now. She's just received a research grant from the European Research Council, which is very difficult to obtain. And she was explaining to us what she was planning to do, what she had proposed to them, and really extraordinary stuff. I always say to my students, I say, even as undergraduates, I'm learning from them. Students should come to Trinity not to be taught, but to learn. In other words, the active process of learning, the notion that you're discovering things. First of all, you're discovering things that other people have first discovered. And then you want to go on and discover things yourself.
David McConnell, thank you so much. Eva McLeisett, both carry on with your great work. My thanks on sound today to Ruth Kennington, to my producer Eileen Heron. Thank you all very much for listening. David, why do you love the song that we're going to close on?
Well, this is Louis Armstrong, of course, one of the very greatest musicians. And I think of jazz as being the great music of the 20th century. He, one of the great singers and great trumpet players. This is the middle 1960s when Janet and I were in California. It was a grim time, Vietnam War and so on. And this song talked about what a wonderful world. And it wasn't very popular in the States, I'm told, at the time, but we picked up on it. But there's a verse in it which I would love your audience to pay attention to. And it, I think it has a lot in it. I hear babies crying. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.